You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Olivia Rosenman. Coming up, we're talking about how media business models are changing. We'll also consider the recommendations made by the Senate inquiry into the future of public interest journalism, and we'll look at the genre of text message news. Joining me in the studio is ABC News reporter Sarah White. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Contributing editor for The New Daily, Quentin Dempster.
Olivia, hi.
And joining us on the line from Melbourne is Crikey's Charlie Lewis. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Olivia.
Deloitte has released their Global Technology, Media and Telecommunications Predictions Report for 2018. And according to them, by the end of the year, subscription revenues will match advertising revenues in media businesses across the board. Now, one publication that has already surpassed that prediction is the New York Times, who last week reported their subscription revenue for 2017 was $1 billion US dollars. This means subscriptions now account for 60% of the company's total revenue. The growth in digital subscriptions contributed to an 8% increase in the New York Times' total revenue in 2017 and reflects the efforts of a strong campaign to boost paying subscriber numbers. Things aren't looking quite so good in Australia, however. According to Deloitte's Kimberly Chang, Australia continues to face a clear challenge in terms of monetization models in news, with most news consumers in the country overwhelmingly reluctant to pay for online news. 90% of Australians surveyed said they were reluctant to pay for news because they could get it for free. But it's not just Australia's problem. Despite Deloitte's predictions, many news and media businesses continue to struggle, and for some, philanthropy is emerging as their saviour. In the US, last week, a billionaire doctor came to the unexpected rescue of the Los Angeles Times and its sister newspaper, the San Diego Union-Tribune, purchasing it for $500 million. Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong owns some of the LA basketball team, the Lakers, and friends of his told the New York Times media reporter that he viewed the LA Times as the ultimate prize of social cachet. The doctor has a bit of a checkered history, which is an interesting side note to the sale. And then there's the model of philanthropically funded not-for-profit news centres like ProPublica, the Centre for Investigative Reporting, and Mother Jones. But there's not really any of those in Australia yet. So let's have a chat about what's going on with some of these more novel models for funding journalism. Quentin, what's wrong with Australians? Why are we so unwilling to pay for news?
Well, why would you when you can get it for nothing? So it's a price point barrier, and the difficulty has been there's been no education by the industry itself that it's worth paying for. The New York Times example you quoted, Olivia, is really heartening news, and they have a porous website where you can get, three or so articles per month, and then they put the hard word on you saying, would you please consider an entry-level subscription, and they've built up their subscription, their hold to the paywall. I've got many issues to raise with Rupert Murdoch, but I think Rupert's right. The paywall should be inviolate, that we want commercial media to survive in this country for all the democratic reasons and plurality of voices and what have you. So we need a monetized model. We've really got to bottom out in Australia to see who's going to be left standing from the digital revolution here, and hope that the New York Times example is an inspiration for the survival of mainstream media.
I agree with you there, but I think the way that Fairfax and Murdoch Press ask for money has a very different tone to the New York Times, or let's say here in Australia, The Guardian, which is much better at asking for money. They do it everywhere on their website. They just a couple of weeks ago had this massive success in funding a new editorial series on environmental issues. I think they raised three times the $50,000 they were aiming for. But it just feels like Fairfax and Murdoch just sort of bang on with this hard paywall without a lot of, as you said, education, without a sort of more, for want of a better word, holistic approach that the New York Times is taking. Sarah, What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people aren't going to pay that money because they don't know what they're getting, like what Quentin was saying. And with that, why The Guardian was so successful is they're saying, your money's tangible. If you hand this money in, we're going to do this amazing environmental investigation and then we'll put it up and we'll show you what we've done. Whereas perhaps with both The Australian and News Corp and Fairfax, they're not saying, this is what we can deliver you. They're saying hard-hitting investigations, but not telling you what kind of investigations. You know, I'd love to see as a reader, if you subscribe, we can give you this kind of investigation, or we can do this kind of work with our readers. If you've got an interesting topic, you could come and talk to us and build that community. I mean, I think we are at a very interesting point at the moment, and Australia is probably at the precipice of something bigger happening. And so we're kind of seeing everyone's a bit unsure where it's going to go in the future.
I saw another issue that's probably playing its part is the job losses that we've seen, the sort of the massive redundancies that we've seen across some of the more mainstream publications over the last couple of years. I think it loses a certain... I think one of the things that you've got to sort of demonstrate is that you're paying for something that you can't get elsewhere. So if you're losing a lot of this... Because a lot of the people who are walking out these doors are very, very specialized and very experienced journalists. And if you're losing that, and you're sticking to much more kind of general reporting, then the feeling is for a lot of consumers, I could get that for free anywhere.
I think another interesting thing to note is that more and more we're seeing that in asking their readers to subscribe, many news organisations are in fact using the language of charity. They're asking readers to support their mission. They're highlighting their public service. They use the word support much more than subscribe these days. And then there are the critics out there who say it's actually not fair for these for-profit companies to paint themselves as social justice charities, that they're making a grab at philanthropic dollars. Quentin, you're having a bit of a giggle there. What do you make of that?
Well, anything that'll work to get the readership and the subscriber, you know, even a sympathy vote will work in a piece of marketing, I suppose. So they've done the qualitative research, I'm sure, to get these asked for the Guardian, which is free and done by a big Quest, and it's funded internationally, and they do have advertising revenue on the Guardian, so there's a commercial model there. They haven't put up a paywall, which everybody appreciates, but they do put the hard guilt-tripped word on you at the end of the article, and even a charitable request, and which people do respond to. But this is niche. We want The Guardian to be mainstream and competitive and viable over the long term. When its altruistic money runs out, we want it to still continue. More voices in a democracy is better. We want the ABC and SBS to be able to be maintained as free taxpayer-funded services of the mainstream with good audience support to make it a really vibrant Australia. But you're right about Fairfax and News not having the smarts, at least, to say this is valuable. And News, which does all the Murdoch papers, the tabloids, they're very popular and they're very engaging, and some are entertaining. Sometimes they're atrocious and have got atrocities of questionable practice in them that we've complained about from time to time. But they are very engaging. We want to see them survive. The Financial Review has got a niche market of well-heeled business operators. Anybody who wants to be in business, well, you've got to subscribe to the Fin Review at $17.99 a week. So they'll know where their market is. It's the broad stream media that we want to survive, and we're still going through the phase of the revolution to see where everybody lands.
And I think it's really tricky with the money. I mean, what's the other option to get a big funder like these? What if you got a really dodgy person saying, yeah, I'll take over the Herald or I'll take over News and I might just control the editorial or I'll slowly...
Well, Gina Reinhart nearly did.
Exactly.
Know.
And I just think that kind of money, and we're always told in journalism...
Barnaby will get a pretty good run out of that, wouldn't he?
Oh, God. But they're always saying in journalism, you know, you follow the money. That's where the story is always at. And then imagine if the money was tied up with the, you know, with these places that are meant to be the fourth estate, that are meant to be bringing truth and investigations to society. I just think sometimes maybe it is better to crowdsource rather than rely on one heavy donor.
Considering the different ways that the people that have bought news organisations in recent years, I'm thinking of this Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong in with the LA Times, of course Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post. These people are kind of painted as saviours, quite different to someone like a Gina Rinehart. So, Charlie, perhaps I'll throw this to you. Is there such a thing as a philanthropic media mogul, or is a Jeff Bezos just as bad as a Gina Rinehart?
Well, I mean, that's probably a level of diagnosis of Bezos's motivations that I probably couldn't make. I mean, I think, look, you obviously have a certain view of the world if you want to own a media company, and I think the other risk with that is that having an avatar like that that's so connected to your brand and you rely on it, if they are suddenly found to be, as you say, as you sort of talked about with this doctor, if you're found to have questionable things about them, that can really undermine a lot of the reporting that you do. I think that's probably the biggest issue of having a single very wealthy benefactor, is that you've got one particular area, whereas obviously, The Guardian can say this is something that all our readers wanted us to look into, and that's why they gave so generously.
All right. So there's this other model that's very popular in the US, which is independent, not-for-profit centres doing investigative and public interest journalism. One Count made at least 150 of these centres. Sarah, what do you think is holding back the development of centres like this in Australia?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people would want investigative journalism, but maybe they think the appetite's not there, or they're not getting enough money to fund it. You're seeing, and I guess the value put on investigative journalism is seeming to be less, given that a lot of investigative journalists are being let go, and people with a lot of experience are being told there's no job for you and you're going to be made redundant, and we want people to turn around stories quickly. So I guess if you look at the Australian market, you'd think, well, it's not like we're thriving off investigative journalism at the moment. Why would we want to invest? And you look at some models that, I can't even remember the name of that website that did exactly that, wanted to become an investigative website, and it just had to close because it was so unmemorable now that I can't remember its name, but it had to close because no one was going there and no one was watching it. But it's almost like re-educating our readers, saying, no, this is actually really important. We want to invest in it.
Or one lawsuit could take you out. That's a real difficulty. Look, I'm on the Walkley Foundation. We've been grappling with this problem about altruistic donations, charitable trusts, and what have you, to fund projects of investigative journalism. And there's a lot of talk going on about that at the moment. To try to persuade the public about fan-based or crowdfunding. Crowdfunding of investigative journalism, you can do it. You can do it on the idea. The former finance journalist for the Herald, Michael West, has set up his own website. How he's surviving, I'm not exactly sure. I subscribe to it, and I'd encourage others. You can go from $5 a month to however much money you've got a month to give him a hand. The cartoonist Alan Moyer has got a website on $4 a month. Some other journalists.
And Ginger from ABC's got
Ginger
one.
Gorman. Ginger Gorman. Yeah.
There you go. So that's starting up with their fan base and their favourites. Hopefully they can get an income to keep the wolf from the door. A lawsuit could take Michael West out if it was successful. He's got to defend himself, and he's treading on toes as an investigative journalist. That's why I want the mainstream to do the work.
And on the flip side, then Ginger Gorman does all these investigative pieces, and then it gets ripped off by other media outlets. And she's always saying, this is my piece. I haven't been paid for this. I've invested all this time and energy into my investigation, and websites just rip it. So you think, oh, like...
Well, there's no honour amongst thieves, and no. It's appalling. And how you protect your original work. The subscription model does do that to an extent. And although with cut and paste, again, Rupert Murdoch is right, with cut and paste and Twitter, people cut and paste and put on Twitter or their Facebook page things that they might have got from subscription, from the subscription model, and then it goes all
over. Well, absolutely, and there's often many easy ways to get around paywalls with incognito browsers, which is why I think the hard paywall approach of Fairfax and Murdoch is not as effective. Another reason why it's not as effective as the New York Times or the Guardian trying to educate people on why they actually should support the work. All right, now we will have to move on to our next topic. You're listening to Author's Day. The Senate inquiry into the future of public interest journalism ended last week, and it has issued a long report that includes a list of 8 recommendations. For anyone's memory that needs refreshing, the inquiry was established last year to investigate the current state of public interest journalism in Australia and around the world, the role of government in ensuring a viable, independent and diverse service, the impact of search engines and social media, and the adequacy of current competition and consumer laws to deal with those search engines and social media, and of course, fake news. Now, the first 2 recommendations were about ensuring adequate and secure funding for the ABC, SBS, and community broadcasting, which of course this show relies on for its existence. Quentin, you've spent a lot of time at the ABC in your career. You're not there now, so I can ask you that without a conflict of interest. But do you think that ABC and those other organisations are adequately funded now?
Demonstrably not, particularly when they're not keeping up with inflation and operating costs. And the Justin Milne, the chairman of the ABC, and Michelle Guthrie had their first public meeting last week, and they said the ABC, even with the growth of population, the ABC is now costing Australian taxpayers just 4 cents a day, as opposed to 8 cents in the early 1990s. So there's been no growth. The ABC, to its credit, and although we've got it's a flawed institution, we know it makes mistakes and all that, it has been able to secure its place as a mainstream broadcaster in Australia through harnessing the digital revolution, because every piece of audio that's made, every piece of video that's made, everything that comes in from syndicated copy or the ABC's foreign correspondence that can be used multiple times, every piece of copyright in the archive can be used. It's a huge taxpayer investment in content. But to stay in the game, particularly now with all the other media in distress and in extremis as far as its survival is concerned, the ABC is not adequately funded, and nor is SBS. Multicultural Australia, as Malcolm keeps saying, you know, the greatest multicultural country, SBS should have enhance its existing multilingual services in radio in particular, so that new arrivals to Australia can turn on the SBS radio and hear the languages of their originating country to feel included. That I can't think of a greater counter-terrorism move than to make newcomers feel welcome in this country. So they're not adequately funded, and it's a disgrace that what Tony Abbott and Joe Ohoki did in 2014 when they lied. Well, Tony lied to the public when he said he would maintain real funding to the ABC and SBS.
Sarah, the final recommendation in that report was to expand legal protections for whistleblowers and other confidential sources for journalists. It's almost funny that should come out last week, considering the new national security legislation that we also spoke about on this show last week. So do you think that the government is going to take this on board?
The way that the government's going at the moment, particularly with their almost homeland security style approach to terrorism, I can't see them wanting to protect whistleblowers. But, you know, you see how important it is to protect whistleblowers when you look at, even with the WikiLeaks situation, they didn't protect any of the people who gave them those documents. And that's what makes me so angry about WikiLeaks. When you look at our own Australian institutions, stories don't happen without whistleblowers. So I think they should be definitely, you know, protected, but also I think we should always look at the motivations behind a whistleblower too, and always make sure we know exactly why they're wanting this information to come out.
Charlie, one glaring gap was any recommendation on how to manage the challenges from Facebook and Google. Apparently, the inquiry wasn't able to find sufficient evidence of the tech giants' influence on the local media sector. It's funny because we're talking about the influence and impact on the local media sector of Google and Facebook every other week, it feels like, on this show. What do you make of that finding?
Well, I think it sort of it points to some of the inadequacies of the process and the report in general. I think it gave a chance for a lot of people to wax lyrical about the importance of journalism, which is obviously true, but I also think journalists do enough of that in their day-to-day work. But you do wonder just how effective it can be if it leaves out areas like that. And I think, as you say, there would be no argument for me at all that the ABC and SBS need adequate, better funding, and as do community broadcasting areas. But you do wonder if some of the more the real stuff that I think that journalism needs from the government to function better is, and it does mention these two defamation laws and more protections for whistleblowers. But you do wonder whether that has any political traction at the moment, given all the other issues that the government is dealing with. And as Sarah points out, given their focus on national security as a kind of rallying cry, whether that's I see that obviously there's a bit of a unity ticket at the moment in terms of media organizations opposing this legislation, and there's been some talk about rowing back very slightly, but there's not going to be, as I understand it, any kind of blanket exemption for journalists. So that those risks are still there, I think.
Quentin, the senators rejected several submissions calling for some form of direct subsidy from government, either for existing media companies or to encourage new entrants into the market. Why do you think that was rejected outright?
Well, it's unsaleable politically. It's just a taxpayer handout, and there'd be great critics of it. The tax deductibility of media subscriptions is interesting, but I think that's going to be hard to sail through. It won't sail through as well. The government investment in the public broadcast is the answer to that. If there's market failure elsewhere, and while the digital revolution is disrupting the market model, the monetized journalism for commercial operators, you'd think it'd be a big argument to maintain the adequate level of funding for the public broadcasters. But that hasn't happened because of Rupert and Tony wanting to put the boot into the ABC in particular. We really do have to, I think, work together to get the public to accept that they should pay for the journalism. We should do some more work on regional outlets, regional online, digital, but there should be some payment for it, and we should get the public to a stage where, yes, we support popular mass involvement digital journalism right through the regions of Australia. That's the way to... And that's why when you asked initially why the New York Times... I know it's a huge catchment that's got global reach, but the same model of getting people to pay for their journalism is a good way to go.
And I think the music subscription model is actually a good example in Australia. I think when I used to be a music writer, when they said Spotify's coming out, we're thinking no one's going to pay for that because you can just go onto YouTube or you can go anywhere to try and get this music that you like listening to. But Spotify has been hugely successful here. In fact, they've got so many more subscription models coming out, and this whole idea of piracy and the arts. You know, I mean, it is tricky for the artists, and they're saying it is a huge issue in Australia, but people are paying for their music, so why shouldn't they pay for their journalism?
You're listening to Fourth Estate. You're with me, Olivia Roseman, and I'm speaking to Sarah White, Quentin Dempster and Charlie Lewis. More and more news organisations are trying to reach their audiences directly through messaging apps. ABC launched a Facebook Messenger bot in 2016, and by its first birthday, late last year, ABC reported at least 250,000 sign-ups. Right now, the New York Times has a special messenger within the New York Times app that is framed as a direct link to their Olympics reporter on the ground in South Korea, Sam Manchester. And I've got to say, I did pose a direct question to him and he responded. So there is definitely something going on there. Yeah, he's not purely a bot. But for both the ABC Facebook Messenger and the New York Times Winter Olympics Messenger feature, the tone is quite different from the omniscient, formal voice of, say, the regular push alerts that come through the New York Times app. They're both going for a conversational tone, trying to match the register of real text messages, complete with emojis, GIFs and acronyms. Charlie, what do you think about delivering the news in this way?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. I subscribe to the ABC's messenger and I find it quite handy. I mean, I was talking to my colleague today, and I sort of thought, oh, yeah, I think this is a really good idea. I should be interested to hear what the rest of the panel makes of it all, because the response I got from the office was a bit more like, oh, it's very bubble. It's the kind of thing that, as a rabid news consumer, you would really like. But if you weren't if you weren't, if, but for the standard news consumer who's a bit more passive about how they take in, it could be quite intrusive and annoying. So I'm not quite sure where I stand. I'd like to hear what the other guys have to say.
I personally don't love it, only that I don't want it to come into my personal Facebook page. But on the other hand, I have a work Facebook page where I post all my things, so I try and keep it quite separate. And I liked with the New York Times how they've got a special app. If I had an app that directly told me and fed in me information, I'd enjoy that a lot better than it infiltrating into my private life or dropping into my, you know, sliding into the DMs of my Instagram saying, hey, like, I've got a cool story for you. I don't want to hear that. I just want to be on Instagram sharing my nice pictures. But I do think it's valid that we do speak to the audience how they want to be spoken to on these kind of apps. But I would prefer it to be, that's what you use that app for. Don't slide into my DMs.
The any interactivity from the audience is huge. And I'm a user of Twitter, and the interactions with critics, trolls, everything else is a fascinating process. Sometimes you learn a few things you didn't know, and criticisms that are valid, quite apart from the ones that aren't valid. So it's what I'm saying is it's the interactivity with the audience. Even posting articles and videos where people ask to comment on them, that's been a huge increase. The hashtag phenomenon, even on Q&A on broadcast television, where people send their Twitter posts in, is fascinating. So the audience is empowered, and I think that is a great aspect of the digital revolution. And of course, we can get into manipulations of that through fake news and what have you. That's being debated all the time now. But the power of individuals to get in on the debate or the argument or add something of value to it is very empowering. And I'm good on everybody who are exploring these things.
I definitely wouldn't quarrel with you on that. I think the messenger in particular maybe is a little bit limited, though, in the amount of interaction you can actually have with it. You can either read more of that particular story or just skip.
I understand, yeah.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, the community, I'm not totally against the idea of building a community. If I post something on my work Facebook page and get a lot of people responding, it then stems all these other conversations that then I can actually get story ideas from, or other people can talk, and then, you know, it becomes this great community and the story lives on for weeks. So I posted about Barnaby Joyce last week as it broke, and it's people are still commenting on this saying, what, you know, what's the public's right to know. So I think the idea of building a community is awesome, but I just, as a personal user, would prefer not to infiltrate.
But I think it's interesting line that you've drawn there, and I don't doubt that there would be many other people that would draw that line, but I think probably it's only a matter of time, right? Like, think about the evolution of your Facebook feed in the past 5 years, exactly. Where it used to be much more of your personal, private, you know, friends and family. It's now a lot of news, a lot of other stuff. So perhaps it's only a matter of time breaking everyone down. Now, unfortunately, that is all we have time for on Fourth Estate. Thank you so much to my guests, Sarah White. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quentin Dempster, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
And Charlie, thanks for joining us on the line.
Thank you for having me.
And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Fourth Estate podcast so you'll never miss an episode. And if you're already a subscriber, please leave us a review on your podcast app or on Facebook, or you could even recommend the show to a friend in real life. And you can stay in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Olivia Rosenman, and you can catch us next week on Fourth Estate.